Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are two doctors of pharmacology at Providence, Alaska Medical Center, Dr. Daniel Britt and Ted Semper. We'll be discussing pediatric pharmacology, that is the factors that affect how medications are absorbed, distributed, metabolized, and excreted, particularly in the pediatric age group. So if you've got children and those children are taking medications, this would be an excellent time to call and ask questions that may be on your mind. You can reach us with questions and comments in Anchorage. Our toll-free number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, you can also email us during this next hour at line1@alaskapublic.org. Danielle and Ted, welcome to Line One. It's nice to have you here.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
This is the first program I've done in the 10-plus years I've been doing this on pharmacology. So let's start by just talking about pharmacists in general, your training, what you're doing. And if you don't mind, you can kind of expand into your particular responsibilities at Providence. So Danielle, you want to go first?
Sure. So the traditional training, at least nowadays, it used to be in the past that there was an extended bachelor programs for pharmacist training. Now there's only the professional PharmD program throughout the United States. So typically what that means for people, if they're interested in becoming a pharmacist, is they do the prereqs or get a bachelor degree, and then they go ahead and do the four-year professional program. After that, it can be followed up if they have a specialty area in a general residency, and then if they'd like to specialize in critical care, oncology, pediatrics, or infectious diseases, or residencies that are all offered for pharmacists. Mm-hmm. For my responsibilities at Providence, I'm currently the NICU/maternity center pharmacist. So my main station is I work in the NICU. Providence has the only level 3 NICU in the state of Alaska. So we accept children between 22 weeks gestation all the way up to term birth. I monitor those patients. I do a lot of the kinetic dosing, so there's certain antibiotics, anti-seizure medications that require specialized dosing based on blood levels. I adjust those. I review all the patient's medications, including the maternity center. I also do kinetic dosing for the adult maternity center patients. I do quite a bit of drug education with them. I do some medication and lactation consults throughout the day. And then I also participate in rounds with the doctors and go over the patients and make dosing recommendations and drug recommendations throughout the day, too.
Mm-hmm. So let me take just a second. I think that's kind of neat to know. Rounds that you're mentioning is when physicians and other healthcare providers are involved in taking care of a patient. They may get together and kind of not necessarily impromptu, but in a scheduled way to talk about situations that arise, and some of those situations involve therapeutic suggestions on how to use certain medications or how to adjust dosages or even choices of drugs because of safety issues.
Yeah, correct. Okay. So typically the rounds that I attend, and they're offered every day, is through the NICU, not the maternity center, and they meet, and for them, the doctors, it's a chance for sign out the way they work, the doctor coming off and the doctor coming on gets to know the patients. But we briefly go over the patients. Dietary is there, social work's there, so we talk about the patient as a whole and what basically can we do to progress this patient closer to discharge home.
Okay. All right. I had a question there for a second, but it slipped me. Ted, what do you do over there?
So I'm in the pediatric ICU and the pediatric unit as the pharmacist. It's very similar as we adjust dosing levels as well based on the drug levels of antibiotics. I also do discharge teaching to do patients there so that so if parents are uncomfortable about new medications that they're going home on, then I can educate them. Answer a lot of questions from nursing, and we also do rounds twice a week that I'm involved in. So very similar with the NICU, and Danielle and I actually switch 1 week a month so that we both stay up to date on both areas.
If I were to ask you, Ted, what is the most common pediatric concern in the intensive care unit and maybe on the peds floor? What kind of medications or specific medications do you think you get the most questions about or discuss the most issues you might? Is it like antibiotics or is it anti-seizure medications?
I'd say the most would be the antibiotics. Uh-huh. First off, on the kinetics of the drug levels, We're consulted a lot about adjusting the dosing on that. And then also, not every antibiotic will cover, not every bacteria is covered by an antibiotic, and so we have to adjust antibiotics based on what bugs. Mm-hmm. And so we're consulted on that, of asking what is a better antibiotic.
And another thing that you said, Daniel, which surprised me just a little bit, is that there you can go and do special extra training in certain areas like infectious disease. I didn't realize we'd gotten that detail with the pharmacologists.
Yeah, we have.
Wow. So how long is that training?
You have to do the general residency first, and that's a year. And then I think it varies from 1 to 2 years, depending on your specialty.
Okay. And the comment I was going to make, or question, but really was NICU, if you hear that, that Daniel used, that means neonatal intensive care. So that's newborns and younger that really need 24-hour, around-the-clock kind of care. John, you're on line one. We see that you came in pretty early and have a question, so let's take your call.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
You betcha.
I was calling because my son has started taking a corticosteroid inhaler, Flovent, and one of my understandings is that not a lot of research and testing has been done on this with kids, and so my concern is just how it gets processed, because I wonder how it will impact his overall growth as an 8-year-old.
That is a common and wonderful question. Let's see what the pharmacists have to say.
Well, first off, the benefits of the corticosteroids being inhaled now is it attacks straight to the lungs, and very small amount of it actually gets into the bloodstream. And since it doesn't get into the bloodstream, it doesn't affect the growth of the children that they've seen. And so that's the benefit of taking the inhaled versus taking a steroid by mouth.
Okay. Daniel, any comments?
Ted's absolutely correct. There hasn't been a ton of studies, but there has been a few studies in children and I think the results were far greater than the side effects for the inhaled steroids. It improved kids' lung function enough where they weren't missing school, parents weren't missing sick days, and it was allowing them better progression to interact with their daily life skills that they need, especially throughout school. I believe there were several studies done looking at growth specifically in kids. I believe two of those studies said that they found no difference between after a couple years on the medication and growth. I think the last study did find that there was a small amount of children not meeting their growth requirements, but when those medications were discontinued, the children were able to return to their prospective places they would be on the growth chart.
John's, that makes sense to you? Have other questions?
Yeah, that's very clear. Well, I was wondering, too, I mean, just it depends on the doctor managing the medication to determine whether or not he'll be ready to be taken off then, I assume, yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the hardest things to determine is when you can come off of these things. That, you know, let me, since I have done quite a bit of asthma over 30 years, and this is a common question, let me just kind of give you my editorial comments as well. Anytime you're doing any treatment, and we've mentioned this on the program a number of times, you've got to look not only at the risk of the treatment, but the risk of not treating. And what the FDA does not require anybody to say is that untreated chronic asthma leads to a certain percentage of growth retardation. Any common chronic disease may affect growth. So when you're looking at somebody who already may have had some growth impacts when you're giving them steroids, we are absolutely interested in trying to make sure that there are no significant side effects. And for the most part, especially the newer inhaled steroids, somewhat like Flovent, the evidence at the doses that are usually used in this country, I think we are not aware of any significant long-term side effects. On the other side, once you start an inhaled steroid, your likelihood of ending up in the emergency room or hospital or even the doctor's office decreases dramatically. So the risk-benefit ratio for inhaled steroids is very good, and it's not the same for oral steroids.
Oh, that's great. I feel a lot better after.
Let me. One other thing I'd use when I talk to my parents, when you look at oral steroids, we're giving people milligrams of medications. When you live in looking at inhaled steroids, you're given micrograms of medication, and that's 1,000 times different just from the get-go.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
You bet. I love to talk about that. I have talked about it a lot. So I guess one of the points is here to just maybe echo on this question is when things are given inhaled or nasally, which we do a lot, then the automatically, for many products, the risk of systemic side effects decreases pretty dramatically. It's kind of like you're putting that medicine right where you want it to go, but when you take things orally, to a large degree, they become systemically available and can cause a broader degree of side effects. I don't want to say it inappropriately. There's exceptions to all of those rules, but that's one of the nice things about these inhaled products.
That is absolutely correct. And there's even been several studies with inhaled antibiotics that we also can use IV. Right. And they've looked at blood levels. And in some of those studies, they were undetectable when they did blood levels from inhaled. So, okay.
This is kind of a general kind of philosophical question, but where do drugs come from? I mean, there's lots of answers to this question, but you know, what's happening? I mean, obviously we started hundreds of years ago recognizing that certain plants and things, or maybe thousands of years ago, had certain benefits, but what do we do now? How are drugs found, developed, and taken to market?
Well, I can answer that question as when I was in school, I worked in a medicinal chemistry lab where they actually developed potential medications. But 60% of the medications on the market today come from natural sources, from plants, from animals. One of the professors I worked with, he would go out to Papua New Guinea and would scuba dive and bring up different plants from Papua New Guinea ocean floor, and now the medication that he's come back with is showing some anti-cancer effects, and so it's not on the market yet, but that is a good where 60% of them come from natural sources, and then the other 40% we'll actually take those and make modifications on them, or they are synthetically made in the laboratory. Mm-hmm.
So nature still supplies a huge percentage of the new medications as well as the older medications.
Correct.
Another, I think of it as a misconception, so you feel free to tell me if I'm wrong, is that I think the public would answer the question, is a natural medication safer than a man-made medication, by saying that the natural medication's safer. Is that true?
Not necessarily. There's plenty of toxic plants out there that I'm sure numerous hikers could tell you about.
Okay.
It just really depends on the plant. When a lot of the medications are derived chemically, usually their structure is similar to something else. I mean, especially classes of medications, they're all very similar in structure, maybe just have a different chemical group attached to them that accounts for their difference. So just because the initial one, say, started off from a plant-based one and all the rest are synthesized based off that, it doesn't make that the initial one would be any safer, especially when drugs are in the same class.
Another thing that may be worth commenting on is that sometimes the natural products, here I'm thinking about something like caffeine, does have some side effects, particularly if it's used in a medicinal way, but often you can change these medications in the lab and decrease the likelihood of side effects with some. Caffeine may not be the best suggestion and best example of that, more I think about it, but there are medications that may be much more hazardous, but by man-made changes, they become longer in activity, less side effects, and more effective for what you're trying to do.
That is correct. Like, there are some medications that they're actually taking now, and they're trying to put targets on them so that they target certain cells, especially in the oncology arena.
Right.
And so it would be less toxic in those cases.
Mm-hmm. So the idea that natural is better is something we seem to hear all the time, particularly in the media and advertising, and that is not necessarily a true statement. It just depends on a number of factors, and some of the man-made things are far, far safer than taking an overdose of some plant or taking a plant in the wild and eating it, for example. And I don't want to overdo that in the sense of being scary, but it's not necessarily a valid statement. We have another caller. I think I'd like to go ahead and ask that person to let us know what their question is. Billy, you're on line one.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, my question is about antifungal treatments for children, you know, such as ringworm or something like that. And you were talking about natural versus man-made medicines as far as using, like, say, tea tree oil to treat
right.
Ringworm versus the antifungal, either cream or pill.
Right. Okay, so yeah. your question specifically, is tea tree oil safe and effective for a ringworm?
Yeah.
Versus because, something else?
I just heard some of the antifungal medications don't really work anymore.
Okay, all right. Comments?
There has been, not as much in Alaska, but there has been more in the lower 48, some reports of resistance building to antifungals and the same in antibiotics in general. There are probably a numerous factors and oils out there that you could use for topical infections like ringworm. I still believe the gold standard here would be one of your azole-type creams that you could even get over-the-counter and using it, you know, for the, you know, twice a day for the two-week period as directed. If that failed to work, then I still think you would probably move up the ladder and maybe try something orally, an antifungal, to see if you could get it that way. It's quite possible tea tree oil may work, but currently, at least from a hospital standpoint, we don't go that route with herbal medications at this point.
Why?
Well,
hold on, just a second, Billy. I'm asking Daniel why they may not use in the hospital a certain. I'm thinking because the safety and efficacy is not there, and this is an important issue. The medications that are used, as much as we know, have to be tested and proven to be safe and effective. Whereas some of these over-the-counter preparations, that's not necessarily true. So if you're in a hospital and you're treating somebody, you better make sure you're using safe and effective medication. Is that a fair answer?
And that's true. And we actually have a policy at Providence that herbal supplements can't be used in the hospital and not even given by family members. Uh-huh. So we try to stick to what's been approved by the FDA. You know, occasionally we'll have discussions thinking outside the box if we haven't had results. I can remember a couple instances where we've had some resistant thrush, which is a fungal infection in the mouth, where we've had to use gentian violet, which is pretty much, you know, unspoken at that point. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you have to resort to other measures, but as long as your current line of therapy is working, you try to stick to those because they've been proven safe.
Yeah. Okay, and it's like the oral version is safe on children's livers and stuff as far as they know.
Whoa, no, just say, let's make sure we're talking topical versus oral, and there's a difference.
Ringworm can be treated topically with your over-the-counter azole antifungals. I think Lotrimin, there's probably numerous generic
Tenactin,
Micotin. That you can use. Some of those haven't been approved for kids like under the age of 12. I believe the clotrimazole has for younger children. And that's just a simple cream you put on twice a day for 2 weeks. And when we've used it in the hospital, we haven't had any failure rates that I know of to this point. If we did have a failure rate, then we would probably up the scales a little bit and go to something, an oral preparation that would be absorbed more systemically. Oral medications are not, you know, there's sometimes risk involved with those. Liver can be an issue, but most of the time when your child's in the hospital, we make sure that they don't have any liver dysfunction, which would be the main cause to worry about something not being metabolized correctly by the liver. So all that's taken care of usually ahead of time before we know that.
Okay, thank you. That helps a lot. I really appreciate it.
All right. To sum up Billy's issue, Billy was asking about the treatment of superficial fungal skin infections, not particularly dangerous or life-threatening. So the risk-benefit ratio of treatments need to be considered in that light. So that oral medications, which have a little bit more risk, you might want to be more careful with. Most topicals work. We don't know as much, believe it or not, about tea tree oil as we might know about the over-the-counter preparations, because they are also often, they were not over-the-counter, they were more prescription at some point in life. So we have a lot more information. In fact, that's how they got to be over-the-counter sometimes, is because they've been proven so safe and effective. Okay, let's take another call. Jeff, you're on line one.
Yeah, I've got a question about Lyme disease. Regarding with all the stuff that's, like, nothing really yet FDA approved yet for Lyme disease and everything, but for, like, the long-term treatment for somebody with Lyme disease and what would you recommend as the best approach going to treating this?
Okay. You guys want to jump on that one?
I guess I would have to look up some information, to be honest. To my point, practicing thus far, I've never encountered a patient with Lyme disease yet. So it's not something that we see frequently in the hospital type setting.
Okay.
I have seen it, and what I've seen used is doxycycline. And
that's more on the immediate following diagnoses, but years after, once it subsides, but it's still present in the host. And just curious about what your thoughts are of long-term care, Lyme, like Lymeade or any of those stuff on the internet where you're seeing stuff.
Let me bring in a medical perspective on Lyme disease here, Jeff. You want to be very careful here. Lyme disease is caused by a bacteria that's carried by some ticks, and it is extremely treatable at the beginning. Like any infectious disease, once you've had it, you have demonstrable immunity most of the rest of your life. That is, you can measure the presence of the history of an infection with antibodies or other tests. And the presence of those antibodies are not the same as being infected. And there are, it appears, a large number of people or a percentage of people who think they have chronic Lyme disease because of the presence of certain tests, which that's not necessarily the purpose of the test. So sometimes there's semantic issues here. Most people with Lyme disease, just like people with bacterial infections or other things, should be treated, and Lyme disease is a very treatable disease or problem early on. So the long-term chronic Lyme disease issue is a real bag of worms. I think the most important thing is to be careful about that diagnosis first. And so if you don't have it, then no treatment, then any treatment would be more risky.
Yeah.
So you want to be sure.
Okay.
All righty.
Thank you.
You bet. We've talked about a lot of things here, and they all revolve kind of like the kinetics that you mentioned, Ted, earlier. So let's talk about what happens in a general sense. Lots of medications, they all get handled differently. What happens when we take a medication from absorption, distribution, metabolism, excretion?
All right. So first talking about oral medication, when you take a medication, it gets into the gut, and there it will break up and it will eventually be absorbed into the bloodstream. And once it gets to the bloodstream, it will go to the liver, and it's called first pass metabolism, where the medication is metabolized. And sometimes medications can either be active after they're metabolized or they're active before, but then it goes throughout the bloodstream and goes to the site of action. And medications go to different receptors, to different enzymes throughout the body to work. And then once they are metabolized and after they're metabolized, then they can be eliminated through the kidney. And so the kidney is where most drugs are eliminated. Some can be eliminated through the bile and through the stool as well. I just want to, there is a difference in children versus adults. Sometimes people will say that children are just small adults, but they're not. Their absorption is different because sometimes they will hold on to the medication longer. Their pH, the gastric pH, can be increased, and all these can affect the absorption of the medication. For distribution, infants have less fat and more water, and so some drugs that are more soluble in water, we need higher doses of. And then finally, with the metabolism, infants usually have less metabolism than adults, and elimination with the kidneys, their kidney functions are usually less as well. And so sometimes we have to expand how often a child receives a medication.
Okay. Danielle, before we're getting close to a break, but before we do that, why don't we talk? You mentioned that you do some lactation consulting. So another question that comes up is, do medications get into breast milk? Are there some comments to make about that?
To a certain extent, most medications can enter breast milk. Kind of the rule of thumb is there's some acid-based principles involved, but usually it's based on molecular size. So the bigger the drug is, the less likely it's going to cross over into the breast milk. So what I do for the lactation consults pretty much is usually I'll have a list of medications that either the lactation consults through the hospital or the doctor themselves will call me, and they'll ask me to make a recommendation based on those. And so typically I'll look at all those medications and use some clinical judgment, try to look for clinical trials or animal studies to see if I can on absorption if there's question, and then make a recommendation on whether I think it's safe or not for that mother to continue to breastfeed mm-hmm. while she's on those medications.
A lot of medications relate around pain maybe because they're happening in the hospital when moms may have just had a C-section or some other problem. Is there a general rule about the pain medications and their effects on infants that are breastfeeding?
There are a few ones. I mean, typically your postpartum medications you're charged on after delivery of a child, most of the time those are safe because you're taking those in the acute setting, so you're taking them for short term, and usually you're not taking them around the clock, what I mean, on a scheduled basis. So medications like that, while they can cause some increased sedation because they do enter the breast milk for the infant, usually you could either, for one, you know, try to, if you're doing some pumping, pump around those if you're taking a lot of them, or just realize that they're short term, so the effects won't be that great on the infant over long term.
When you said pump, you mean so if you take a medication, then maybe the next breast time you're about to breastfeed or an hour or two after mm-hmm. you've taken it, then you pump your breast,
right.
Assuming that the medications right. have gotten there pretty quickly.
Right. And right. I make that assumption, sorry, because there's yeah. a lot of pumping going on
right.
in the NICU where I work. But if you were just straight breastfeeding your infant, sometimes if the medication's short-lived, is you could time it around, you know, breastfeed your infant and then go ahead and have mom take the med right afterwards. And then that way it's already begun to peak in the body and the blood levels by the time the infant would be due for the next feeding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and take our usual break at this particular time. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number in Anchorage is 550-8433. Let me give it to you again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we're going to continue to take any calls and emails. My guests today are Providence Alaska Medical Center PharmDs Danielle Britt and Ted Semper. And we're discussing pediatric pharmacology issues, that is, effects of medications, side effects of medications in children. So if you've got questions or comments about your child or someone else's child and medications, why don't you give us a call? You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are doctors of pharmacology, Ted Semper and Danielle Britt. They both work at Providence Alaska Medical Center, one in the neonatal intensive care and is involved in neonatal intensive care advice on medications and also on some of the postpartum issues with breastfeeding and mothers and pregnancy and newborns. The other on the general pediatric ward and also with the pediatric intensive care issues. They're really experts on the whole issue of medications and effects of medications. And We've been kind of talking about some phone calls that we've had up to this date, and a little bit about where medications have come from and how they work. I think I'm going to start this half talking about side effects. If there's something else people want to know about, it's side effects and risks. And as we've already discussed, I think it's very important to always remember it's not just what's the risk of a treatment, it's what's the risk of not treatment balanced with that risk of medication. So, big question, what are the risks of medications? What do we know about side effects and risks in kids, and how do we put that in some perspective?
Well, so, I mean, it can be it's variable with side effects when it comes to medications. There's certain side effects, say for antibiotics and say nausea or diarrhea, that are fairly common that just happen by the drug's natural mechanism of action. It kills bacteria, so therefore it wipes out the bacteria in your GI tract, causes the diarrhea. There's also a big one that parents have probably seen, like the amoxicillin rash issue too, which is just a histamine reaction. Sometimes, you know, these are self-limiting side effects. There's not for great cause of concern. There's other drugs too, like I'm thinking the class of ACE inhibitors, which causes cough naturally. It's just by the mechanism of the way the drug works.
So those are some medications that might be used for hypertension, and mm-hmm. particularly in adults.
Yeah, not so much. There's actually a few now.
Beginning to, yeah.
In cardiology, use them for kids to control blood pressure if necessary. But some of these things are, you know, as long as they're not creating a bunch of discomfort in the patient, that, like I said, they're self-limiting. There's something usually you can work through and you finish out your medication. There are other options, like for the cough and the ACE inhibitors, that, you know, if it becomes too troublesome for the child, then the parents can, you know, ask if there's another drug that may be suitable for their child. But that's, you know, not always the case. Sometimes the side effects that cause steroids, be it a good one, oral steroids, not inhaled steroids, it can have a lot of endocrine effects. So weight gains, effects on blood sugar, effect on your adrenal glands. Long-term usage, even though it's a natural side effect, can really change the body's, can change your growth, can change the way your body metabolizes, and sometimes even shorten your life expectancy with chronic use. So like you said, sometimes you have to look at the risk of not treating compared to the risk of treating, knowing the long-term side effects of these medications. Mm-hmm.
Ted, any comments?
So when you asked that, I was thinking more of also the risk of giving too much medication.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, if we gave too much acetaminophen, also known as Tylenol, then it can cause bad effects on the liver. And so that's why it's always important, outpatient-wise, if you have questions about giving your child Tylenol, then you should ask the pharmacist about how much you should give, because the number two reason for liver transplant in this nation today is still Tylenol overdose. And then the other thing is, I mean, simple things as if a child is diabetic and they're on insulin, if they get too much insulin, then it will drop their blood sugar too much. So there are side effects, but as pharmacists, we are responsible to look for those side effects, and we can make dose adjustments as well to prevent those.
Acetaminophen is a pretty cogent example, because the FDA has recently asked companies to kind of reformulate Tylenol or acetaminophen, is my understanding. And it was because in certain situations, well, it was because to a large degree, it's because overdose of acetaminophen, primarily unintentional overdose, was causing some significant problems. At the right level, the right amount, it's okay. But children were getting doses of acetaminophen in more than one product, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And they were misunderstanding the recommendations on or how much to take in the over-the-counter products. And so that was leading to some problems. Is that what happened?
That's correct. I mean, I don't think it's all been changed yet, but there were two previous strengths. There was an infant, which was pretty much 100 milligrams per ml. And then there was a child strength, which was 160 milligrams per 5 mLs.
Hmm.
So what would happen is, you know, parents, you know, just looking, getting used to one label,
right.
Say they have a 5-year-old and they have a baby, and next thing you know, they run out of one Tylenol and they're using it for the other one. And next thing you know, they use that infant Tylenol for the 5-year-old, and 5 mLs all of a sudden went from 160 milligrams to 500 milligrams. So a gross overdose.
The medical, I don't know, I hate to use the word establishment because I don't think of it myself as a medical establishment, but the whole practice of medicine has come under some fire recently, mainly from their own surveillance of complications and side effects and problems. What is being done now, maybe that's different in the past in hospitals to try to alleviate risks of medications in particular?
That's a very good question because at Providence, what we do is we meet weekly and we talk about medication errors that either got to the patient or did not get to the patient, and we look at the process and try to fix the process so that those will not happen. And one area is, it goes along the lines with the acetaminophen suspension, is we standardize all our concentrations at Providence so that we don't have multiple different concentrations of medications. Another area that we do is for children, the pharmacy will actually draw up the exact dose of the medication for each child. That way it's checked by the pharmacy tech who does it and the pharmacist who checks it and then the nurse who gives it. And a second nurse will also check it as well. And those are all safety checks before it gets to the patient.
Another thought that comes to my mind about this is the increasing use of electronic medical records. Seems to me this is one of the areas where there's been lots of benefit. No longer can you misunderstand a doctor's writing about a medication. What are you laughing at, guy? So that two medications that might be distinctly different in what you're trying to do in safety and everything may be misinterpreted. And all the way down the line from the nurse to the pharmacist and back forth. And then there's a lot of, and I think it's been very helpful to have pharmacists not being hesitant, even in an outpatient basis, to call physicians now, particularly with electronic medical records. Maybe it's going to be even better, and say, well, you sure you want to use this dose on this particular child? And you may or may not be able to verify why that's important and so forth. So I think electronic medical records is one of the real advantages is hopefully to decrease some of these kind of medication problems. Do you see that from a pharmacy standpoint?
I do. Recently, we switched to, which I'm sure you've heard of, the Epic system last year. And part of the Epic system, when it came to the chart review and entering orders for the patient, is it can set up best practice alerts. So even for the prescriber, if they're prescribing something for a pediatric patient, it's outside the norm of what's been pre-programmed in there, it will alert that practitioner that, hey, your dose is overdosed, or drug not indicated in this patient age group, and things like that, just to help. And it'll do the same thing from the pharmacist, except to a greater extent, like, are you sure you want this dose or duplicate medication, just to help increase that along.
Mm-hmm. So it gives us the ability to set in a lot more alarms and double checks to make sure that's really what you want to be doing. Oftentimes, parents also ask, and appropriately so, is this medication approved for children? What is the approval process? What's the point of the approval process? Tell us a little bit about what that's all about.
So in order for a medication to be approved, it goes through a long process where a company will submit an application for approval, and then it goes through three different phases of studies, the first one being safety, the second one being safety and some efficacy, and the third one mainly focusing on efficacy. And then the fourth phase is pretty much when it gets on the market. And once it's on the market, then it's continually has studies ongoing. And the FDA will actually look at all those clinical trials and will deem that it is approved for that specific disease. And for children, it's a lot more difficult because it's a lot more difficult to do studies in children and in ladies that are pregnant. And so there's not as many studies in that area. And so there's not as many FDA approvals in children. Not to say that there's not studies in them. There are. There's just not enough studies to be approved by the FDA.
It's my understanding that the purpose of the FDA is to monitor, for the most part, the pharmaceutical companies and require them to demonstrate safety and efficacy before they will license those medications. I think there's a little bit of confusion that physicians are governed by the FDA, and that's not entirely true. I think that's kind of a slippery slope that's beginning to be changed a little bit, and I'm not saying that's bad, but in general, the FDA's purpose is to make sure that the medications that physicians have available, pharmacists have available, have been shown to be safe and effective to a certain degree.
That is correct. And a lot of times, you know, it's easier for a drug manufacturer because, you know, sometimes it can take them up to 7 years to get a drug out to the public, to get an adult approval, because it's easier to conduct your trials. It's in a mass population. And then after the drug's approved on the market, they can do just a short, you know, study with a much smaller patient population, say an adolescent, teenagers, or something like that, that show good benefits. And then they can get the add-on that says that this drug's appropriate for teenagers, too.
I got you. So one of the things that's important for people to hear there is it is very expensive and time-consuming to get a drug to market. And when you're talking about these three phases, that we're talking about thousands and thousands of people. Mm-hmm. That's not easy to do and very expensive. I know it's got to be in the maybe hundreds of millions of dollars to get a drug to market. And then you lose that preferential right to market that after how long?
It's 20 years through patent, but it's from the start of the new drug application. So it only benefits the company the sooner they can get that drug to the public. Uh-huh. Because if it takes them 10, 12 years, then they only got 8 years left on their patent to make money off of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Along the same line, this is maybe getting a little esoteric for some of the listeners, but they may hear these words more again, and that's what the FDA has been using more recently, is something called a black box warning. And black box warnings can't help but increase the fear of regarding a medication. And I think it's imperative in my mind that in those situations where physicians and patients are discussing black box warning, that they really talk to each other very well about the risk-benefit ratio, because some of these medications are extremely useful. The risks are very low but can be very bad, and each individual has their own little risk-benefit ratio depending on their liver disease or their age or so forth. So what's the black box warning? And I don't even remember when it all started, but it's certainly become a bigger issue in the last, say, 10 years for my practice.
So my understanding is the black box warning is kind of like the highest advisory from the FDA. So they're not necessarily persuading the disuse of a drug or saying that the drug can't be on the market anymore. They're just warning the public and to prescribers out there that these significant side effects have occurred with the drug, and to be monitoring for those side effects in your patients. The most frequent one that comes to mind is the recently new ones with the antipsychotic medications and its risk for suicide and attempts and that kind of ideation in adolescents. So it's not saying that those drugs, you can't use them in those patient populations. It just needs stronger monitoring and to be aware of the risk.
Yeah, the suicide one is a very good one example, I think, because, you know, if a tenet is to first do no harm, this is kind of a pet peeve here, but I want the public to kind of, our listening audience to hear this, then we all have to be careful. And when the FDA came out with a black box warning, there's an immediate knee-jerk concern, not only among the public, but also providers, to be more careful. And as a result of the black box warning on antidepressants, the suicide rate in this country was going down. And shortly after that, if I understand what I've been reading, it began to go back up again, simultaneously with a decrease in the number of these prescriptions that were written. So we all overreacted, and as a consequence, there were more problems. Getting back to this risk-benefit ratio, and particularly when we're talking about depression, of which there's naturally a fairly high risk of suicide, and when you're adding another medication. So my understanding is the best I can right now, again, I'm asking you or listeners to call in, let me know, is that there may be a very, very small risk of increased risk of suicide on people that are taking it. There are some warning signs, and so most of us have now taken to just making sure people understand that, but hopefully we're back using these medications, which were being very effective at preventing suicide. Fair to say?
very fair to say. I mean, I do think that there was an overreaction when they first came out and to not use, maybe try to use behavioral modifications or counseling. Mm-hmm. But you have to look, like you've previously stated, at the benefit-risk ratio. If you stop treating a depressed patient, what's the more likelihood that they're going to commit suicide or do harm to themselves than if they were on the medication?
Let me remind our listeners again, we got about 12 to 15 minutes left, something like that. This is a chance to ask questions about medications and kids in particular. Our phone number here in Anchorage is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. You can also go to that to get a list of links that we have to the program for reliable information on these topics. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And also, I think I forgot to mention, if you're listening tonight between 7 and 8, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we will not be able to answer your questions. There's an email question that came in regarding asthma and allergy medications, again, about growth and retardation. Is stunted or delayed growth with asthma allergy drugs such as Singulair, Nasonex, which is a nasal steroid, albuterol, or inhaled steroid? So there's three different kinds of medications this person is asking about. Singulair, nasal or inhaled steroids, which I'll say is one kind of product, and then albuterol. What about the risk of stunted or delayed growth in those three groups of medications?
So with Singulair and albuterol, there has not been any evidence of stunt retardation, growth retardation in those kids. The Singulair is added on. It really is effective if the child has allergies in addition to the asthma. And then the albuterol, of course, the goal with asthma is to limit the use of the albuterol by using the inhaled steroids on a daily basis. And so with the albuterol, it does not cause the growth retardation.
Okay. And we've mentioned it before, the inhaled steroids, it's hard to make I don't want to overstate the problem, but the risk of inhaled steroids and Nasonex at the right dose is highly unlikely to cause any significant growth retardation and we have studies in some of the earlier steroids almost up to 40 to 50 years now. I think for the first inhaled steroids came out quite a long while ago. What about another group of medications that's probably worth talking about? Are medications used for attention and deficit disorder? We're talking about stimulant medications to a large degree and some like that. Who wants to kind of give us some information about those medications?
Well, I'll talk about it. I've done some research with it talked about it with a pharmacy class before. So ADHD medications, and it depends on the age of the child. Usually 4 to 5 year olds, preschool age, they recommend behavioral changes first, and working with behavioral modifications. And then 6 to 11 year olds, they recommend starting stimulant medications as first line medications. These would include methylphenidate and amphetamines. And these are the first line that has shown most effect, and it's good to start at a low dose, and then your physician would increase the dose every 3 to 7 days based on the effect. And it really can make a difference in a child, because the goal is to help them have better grades in school, help them focus, I'm trying to think of other things like different relationships that they want to develop that maybe they couldn't develop without being controlled. And then after stimulants, there is a second line medication called Strattera. It's not a stimulant. And that is a second line because it's not as effective, but it may work as well. And then a third class of medication is called clonidine, and it's a medication that's usually used for high blood pressure, but they've seen effect in ADHD. And these are the medications that are used. There are a lot of concerns with the stimulants. There's been concerns that will this lead them to drug abuse? But they have shown that it does not lead to drug abuse. As pharmacists and physicians, we have to make sure that they are not giving those medications away to other kids that may want those. And also it another myth that people think is, will it cause euphoria in these children? And it does not cause euphoria in ADHD children.
What are the major risk factors for taking? What are the things that we want to worry about the most certainly with the stimulant medications?
With the stimulant medications, I mean, it can interfere with sleep, so you don't want to give it too close to bedtime, of course. Appetite changes. There has been some concern about stunning growth in these children, but the studies have shown 1 to 2 centimeters stunted growth by the time that they're adulthood. So there have been those stunt growths. And they also may cause tics as well. So that's something else to watch for. But they're wondering, is it from the medication or is it part of the ADHD?
Right. Yeah, blood pressure is another thing I've been kind of focusing on increasingly, is being sure that we're not getting some hypertension related to these medications.
Yeah, that's correct as well.
The issue about all medications, kids taking medications, I don't think there's very few mothers and fathers I've ever met in over 30 years of practice who want their kids on any medication. But in particular, the question about drug abuse when kids are taking something like the stimulant medications comes up. And you'd mentioned that there's not much evidence of that. In fact, I think the evidence is that the kids who take it are less likely to abuse drugs later in life. And that seems counterintuitive till you realize the psychosocial factors that you're talking about. Kids who go to school and don't feel competitive, don't feel good about themselves, and they often do other behaviors to try to find themselves feeling good, one of which might be beginning to take illicit or other medications or team up with the wrong group of people that introduce them to those things. So really, I think there's very good evidence to suggest kids who benefit from stimulant medications are less likely to use illicit drugs later in life, which is not what most people would think. One other thing about those medications that perhaps might be worth talking about also, though, unfortunately, is my understanding is the medications, the stimulant medications in particular, have become the drug of use in colleges instead of caffeine now to stay up and study. And that is a federal offense.
It is.
Yes.
to give, this is different than taking a lot of caffeine, that when somebody gives you Adderall to study at night, which it, I guess, will do. I've never taken it, but my understanding from talking to the experts is it increases everybody's attention, even people who are not having problems with attention. So it's effective, and unfortunately, these medications are being abused by college students in a way to help themselves in college. You heard the same things?
I have, and I've actually even heard it with more of high schoolers, too, that some people... you can take it orally. I've heard of people crushing it up and snorting it, even. And it gives the stimulant effect the same that I would assume would be comparable to methamphetamine.
Jeez. I wasn't aware of that. I mean, normally the medications don't – I mean, they really just give you what appears to me when you talk to patients that are on it. This is one example I read somewhere. Some young kid who was pretty bright said, you know, when I'm taking my medication, it's like every day is a clear, quiet, sunny day. When I'm off of it, it's like I'm in the middle of a thunderstorm or a hurricane every day. There's a lot of stimulation and a lot of information that's coming into our brains that we constantly are focusing out. And one of the real problems with attention deficit disorder is that inability, it appears, to really knock that stuff out and decide what's important stuff that comes in. And that's what these medications are particularly good about. We've got a couple of minutes left. If someone wants to call in and give us a call and ask a question, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. lymphoma.org. All right, a couple more general questions. What is a generic drug? What is meant by a generic drug? And in an effort to save money across this country, we're increasingly using more generic drugs. Is that a good idea?
Well, from my perspective, I think it's a very good idea, and it's a good idea for consumers also. As we previously talked about the FDA, you know, during that 20-year period, that whatever manufacturer made that drug has a patent to that drug and can only be reproduced by them. But after that patent expires, really any drug company has the right to come in and make a generic of that product. So people can come in and make that same base drug, be able to have the recipe of that drug and make it, and sell it at a much cheaper price. That the original brand was, and it usually, most of the time, most generics are equivalent to the brand product. There are a few that sometimes more of the natural products you'll get a little bit of variability. I'm thinking here like the thyroid medications. Some people have said Coumadin, you know, there's differences between brand and generic. Not seeing that they're not efficacious, but they recommend that you don't switch back and forth between brands when you're taking some of those medications.
Okay. Along the same line, you know, again, because of cost issues in this country for healthcare, many people ask about taking medications that they get one way or the other from Canada or Mexico. What do pharmacists have to say about that?
I know Canada has their own regulatory system. It is illegal for us to, you know, fill prescriptions from other countries just because they have different entities that regulate their drug system. To my knowledge, you know, the Canadian system has to go through drug tests and things like that, so I'm not sure. I would assume most of their products are safe. I will say, just because I've been on trips to Mexico, a lot of drugs are sold over the counter there, including some of IV preparations like Ampicillin that you'd see in a hospital. Mm-hmm. When you see things like that, you have to be a little bit more cautious about things being sold over the counter with no regulation or quality.
Yeah, we're really becoming more and more concerned about antibiotics. So that has this other risk about antibiotic resistance developing. Mm-hmm. It's another big factor in that. Mexico, same. They have the same regulation?
Well, no. I said from personal experience, I've been to Mexico and I walked into a pharmacy how it was, and you can buy anything over the counter, including Ampicillin.
Okay, I thought you were saying Canada.
Canada's different. You need a prescription.
Okay. All right. Any final comments? We're in our last 30, 40 seconds here. On anything, how would you want to sum up in any way about pharmacology?
I would just recommend to read the labels when you get over-the-counter medications and consult with your pharmacist.
Okay, if you have questions.
If you have questions.
Yep.
Same thing, don't be hesitant to call your doctor, your pharmacist, your doctor's nurse, ask a question. They'll find out the right answer.
All right. Well, we've got through another day. I think very much, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. It's been wonderful. Hopefully our listening audience have gotten something out of it, or at least as much as I did. It's been very, very enjoyable. Thanks very much to both of you. Today, my guests were Daniel Britt and Ted Semper, PharmDs at Providence Hospital. If you'd like to continue this conversation, you can certainly join us in KSKA on Facebook, where you can find these links to this on our website, alaskapublic.org. Also, why don't you join us next Monday afternoon, January 30th at 2 p.m., when the next edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection, resumes. Our topic's going to be, what, in general, children seem to always be trying to get what they want. And after all, they didn't come programmed to know how to behave. So when might disobedience, hostility, defiant behavior really be a problem, or be oppositional defiant disorder? This Monday, my guest Richard Steinwig will help us decide. So why don't you join us on Monday, January 30th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web engineer, web editor, and audio engineer. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.